This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest this episode is Richard Vevers, founder and CEO of the Ocean Agency. In addition to being one of the most dedicated and articulate environmental activists working today, Richard is a pioneer of underwater 360-degree photography and actually invented the cameras that took Google Street View underwater. It was the project of producing a comprehensive virtual reality record of the ocean that led to the work Richard is doing now, which centers around raising consciousness on the devastation of coral reefs.
Richard Vevers is documenting the ocean's reefs the same way Google maps out streets.
It's really about trying to communicate the science as much as doing the science itself. To take people on a journey.
More on that project in the second half of our show. I started off, however, by asking him to share his decision years ago to leave the advertising business and move headlong into ocean conservation.
Well, I started off in advertising in London, so was working at some of the top agencies for about 10 years. And it was, you know, a great time, up until the point where you realize you didn't feel quite right. And I had a very bad meeting one day and decided to pretty much storm out and have a complete sea change, literally. I decided to become an underwater photographer and moved to Australia, started diving on the Great Barrier Reef. And that sort of career change was actually quite a lot harder than I thought, going from the security of advertising to suddenly having to be self-employed, working to try and raise an income. Was extremely difficult, and I found myself diversifying into working with a lot of conservation organizations. And I really knew very little about the ocean at that stage. I was always passionate about the ocean, but I didn't realize any of the issues going on. And certainly as a diver, you never get taken to locations where you see problems. So you're just ignorant of the issues. But when I started working with conservation organizations, aquariums, etc., with this new career, I realized there were massive issues going on, but very little awareness of them.
Let me ask you a little bit before you go on with this, because I do want to know, it's a dramatic change. I mean, going from ad agency, and I get it, you know, it's a very, you know, high-pressure environment. It makes you look almost visionary, however, if you look at the state of advertising today and the fact that they're struggling to such a degree that they are. But why was it just almost, I'm out and now I'm going to follow my bliss, I'm going to do something that gives me joy? Or did you already have a feel for what you wanted to do and it was ocean or diving related?
No, I'd like to say that it was planned, but it was literally a very bad meeting after a couple of very bad years of working on things like four-ply toilet tissue, where you're up all night getting really stressed about something that you feel isn't that important.
Okay.
So you're trying to make big companies money through creativity, and you realize that creativity is really almost wasted, it felt like, at the time. So you come to a point where in advertising, it's either your life or you have to walk away at that point. And I chose to walk away after, a single very bad meeting.
Had you envisioned then that, you know, down the line, you'd be doing what you're doing today? Did you know that whatever it was, you were going to be led into doing something around the oceans or diving or conservation? Or did it just feel like the most natural thing for you to do and it evolved into a new career for you? I'm just curious. Time out or career plan?
It was a career plan, but without the plan. Mm. So I knew I'd love the ocean. And I need to do something at that stage that I loved. So maybe it was sort of time out, but I didn't see any way of going back to the kind of job that I was doing in advertising. So how could I work for another big company? I felt I needed to work for myself, and I needed to do something I was passionate about. How that was going to pan out and whether or not I could make a success of being an underwater photographer, being an underwater photographer, I had no idea at that stage, but it just felt like my only real option.
And it took a while, from what I see. I mean, you were involved in several projects before the Ocean Agency came into being. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the work you did before you set it up and founded your own group?
Well, when I left advertising, yes, I initially had some success as a underwater photographer. I set up an exhibition within 3 months, and I actually sold quite a bit of work. I soon realized that it's very difficult to make money as an underwater photographer. So I diversified into setting up a gallery, doing painting, so really sort of promoting other people's work as well as my own work, but then diversifying into design. So working with conservation organizations, bringing the skills that I have from advertising into that sort of area. And I did big exhibits with people like Sydney Aquarium, which is the largest attraction in Australia. And I did a big exhibit around sharks. So it's slowly sort of morphed into some very different roles, but it gave me this huge opportunity to build a network of the ocean conservation community.
You're very blunt in promoting your agency in terms of saying that there are lots and lots of ocean-focused conservation organizations out there, but you had a belief that it could be done differently, that you could leverage this idea of kind of marketing and advertising and bring ideas around science and technology to bear to make a difference. Can you explain that a little bit? I mean, how it came into being and why the Ocean Agency is different from others in your estimation?
Well, in advertising, you do a lot of background sort of research. And now I looked at the funding of conservation, especially ocean conservation. And out of every $100 that's given to charity, about $4 makes it to the environment. And about 40 cents or something around that level makes it to ocean conservation. So you've got very little to play with in the first place, and we've got quite a lot of ocean conservation organizations out there. So I think the last thing the world needs was another ocean conservation organization competing for what is a very small amount of money. And often that money can't be used efficiently. So you've got the same issue with the science. Most scientists in sort of ocean science have to spend a massive proportion of their time applying for grants because there is so little funding and so much competition. So we need to really increase the demand and support for ocean science and conservation as a priority rather than sort of have someone else competing for the minimal funds that are available.
So do you come in and serve as a kind of intermediary, kind of a matchmaker, if you will, finding and circumventing some of the bureaucracy and some of the costs associated with kind of just raising the money and supporting it? Or are you actually your own standalone organization with your own agendas and your own projects?
Well, we actually do work as a sort of intermediary. So, for example, the traditional process, we didn't have a global survey of coral reefs. That uses the same methodology. So it's very difficult to compare one region to another and to really understand what's going on. So traditionally what you would have to do is apply for government funding or philanthropic funding, but it's incredibly difficult to do that across borders. So it's a funding model that is flawed in many ways. And the amount of time that has to be spent in applying for those funds makes it almost impossible. So we thought, well, this is very sponsorable. If a company can sponsor a football team, why not sponsor a science team to do this? And we brought in a corporate sponsor to do the global survey of coral reefs that we conducted over a four-year period. And they received about a five-fold better return on investment than traditional sports sponsorship. So suddenly you've got a way of funding the science at scale, and it's making money.
So public-private partnerships set a new level.
Absolutely. And bringing in just different funding to allow us to move at a speed that's just not possible with the current model.
When you did the survey, was there indication that the reefs were starting to bleach? And I'm going to have you tell the listeners a little bit about what's at stake. Or was this before the problem really started to raise its head?
Over the last 30 years, we've lost about 50% of corals around the world. And that's been mainly due to sort of the local threats. So overfishing, where you lose certain fish that keeps essentially the gardeners of coral reefs, and you can get the ecosystem collapsing very quickly. You've also got pollution, which is mainly sort of land-based pollution from developments on along coastlines, from agriculture as well as sort of city developments. So they're all having major impacts on coral reefs. But then you've got the new threat that's coming, which is climate change. And that's impacting coral reefs in three main ways. One is the bleaching that people have often heard about now, where the water's simply too hot for the corals, and they are dying en masse. We had the worst ever die-off over the last few years. But we've also got bigger and more intense storms, which is a direct result of warmer ocean temperatures. And then you also get big disease outbreaks because the corals are under stress from the storms and the warm water. So you've got this threefold increase, which is having a dramatic effect on corals around the world. And the situation is only going to get worse for the next 2 to 3 decades.
Richard, besides being just beautiful to look at, what's at stake here? What does it mean with respect to the ocean's ecosystem and the life that it supports?
Well, coral reefs are just hugely important, and people don't really recognize that. They support something close to 500 million people for food and income. They support a quarter of all marine life. So they're essentially the nurseries of the ocean. Corals are amazing animals. They are the builders. So they build these giant cities, you know, that dwarf anything that humans have ever built, which are home to a million species. So the knock-on effect of losing corals and coral reefs is massive. It's estimated that coral reefs are worth about $375 billion each year to the global economy. So it's an issue that we can't afford to just ignore.
This is in terms of those that live and rely on the oceans for their livelihood. So fishing villages to commercial size fishing to anybody and everybody else who gains their livelihood from the ocean. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. And you've only got to look at sort of big issues like the more intense storms that are hitting coastlines. It's being researched for coral reefs. Protects coastlines by absorbing about up to 97% of the wave energy. So if you lose your reef, suddenly you get massive impacts on coastal developments. So that is issues from the insurance point of view. You've also got issues with things like you're something like 400 times more likely to find new drugs on a coral reef than in terrestrial environments. So hugely important drugs for especially cancer, pain relief, are really coral reefs are the place to go and search for those drugs.
So the water-based equivalent of rainforest.
Absolutely. And those are the two, it's a big comparison. Rainforest, which is more diverse as an ecosystem and which is more important as an ecosystem, Both are critically important to the planet and the economy when you look at it from that global perspective.
This is Inside Asia. You're listening to my conversation with Richard Beavers, founder and CEO of the Ocean Agency. His mission is the subject of the Netflix original documentary, Chasing Coral. Stay with us. I'm Steve Stein. You're listening to Inside Asia. Let's get back to my conversation with Richard Beavers, founder and CEO of the Ocean Agency and a key player in the Netflix original documentary, Chasing Coral. In the second part of our conversation, I turn our attention to Asia. As our listeners know, I live in Bali and I'm a diver myself. I've visited some amazing coral gardens in the region throughout the years. One of the most stunning and one of the earliest encounters was with Australia's Great Barrier Reef. 30 years ago, the variety and diversity of coral and sea life was simply overwhelming. So much has changed. I start off by asking Richard, what's at stake, particularly in Asia, and what, if anything, can be done?
Asia is arguably the most important region for coral reefs. It is the sort of refuge where coral reefs retreat to in ice ages. And so over time, it has become the most biodiverse place, arguably, on the planet. Because coral retreats back and then expands. So the further you get away from Asia, the less biodiversity there is on coral reefs generally, and the more vulnerable those reefs are because of the lack of biodiversity. So when you look at the big issues like climate change hitting coral reefs, Southeast Asia, especially for the coral triangle, which is an area where you've got the greatest biodiversity, which includes, you know, Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, especially right out to sort of Papua New Guinea. That area is just critically important, but it is arguably less vulnerable than other areas. So really important we focus efforts on really bolstering protection of critical sites within Southeast Asia, especially.
Almost as a fallback strategy. Is this the idea that in some areas of the world that the reefs are already so extensively compromised it may be hard to get them back, so therefore focus on areas where you can do something now when maybe the damage hasn't been so extreme? Is that the argument?
Yes, absolutely. So we know that we're going to lose about 90% of the remaining reefs because of the heat already in the system from climate change.
Over what period of time, Richard?
Yes, it is over the next 2 to 3 decades. So by about 2050, that's the heat that's already in the system. Until we stabilize or reduce the rate of global warming, we are going to have continued threats from bleaching events, greater storms, etc. And that's going to increase. So we know we're going to lose a lot of coral reefs. So what we need to do is the science to identify which are the areas which are least vulnerable. And there's a huge variation in that vulnerability. So, for example, you've got places which are the most vulnerable, which are places like Galapagos. And it lost pretty much all of its corals in the early 80s when the global bleaching events really started impacting reefs. But at the opposite extreme, you've got locations like we were just recently out in Manado in Indonesia. And we visited that just before the global bleaching event and just after the global bleaching event. And the reefs appear to be actually in slightly better condition than before this global die-off.
How do you explain that?
That is simply down to the location and its vulnerability. So you've got areas where the bleaching hits first and is more likely to hit, and you've got other areas which are naturally protected. So they've got deeper water and currents flushing through. You've got additional cloud cover because they're close to the equator. There are so many different factors for every single location that affects their vulnerability.
So given that there's such an important ecosystem of corals in this triangle in Southeast Asia, what are the governments that you mentioned earlier in this region doing about it? Or can they do anything about it? Or are they entirely dependent on multilateral lending and funding and organizations like yours to support the preservation of those reefs?
Yes, the governments have a huge role to play. You know, what we need to be doing in the short term is ensuring that we protect critical areas from all the local issues. And that's really about how development is happening on land, and we're putting in place the protection that allows that development without having a sort of major impact on the reefs, which we need to buy time for. So there is so much that can be done on that local basis once we've done the science to identify these key areas. And a lot of that science has already been completed. But the key thing is making sure there is demand for coral reef conservation. And people, generally, there was a recent study done in the United States which showed that people, one, don't really understand the issue, and two, don't really prioritize the issue.
When you say people, Richard, are you talking about people living in these areas or just the general public around the world not understanding implications of, the coral reefs and the role they play in the preservation of our oceans?
Well, I think in this day and age, there are so many environmental issues that it's hard to prioritize them.
Oh, I see.
And the studies that have been carried out show that people, yes, are starting to get aware that there's issues for coral reefs, but how does that rank against all the other issues out there? And certainly coral reefs are seen to be these places you go on holiday, which are lovely to look at, but people don't really understand their economic importance and their importance to cultures. They haven't been prioritized. And because it's an issue that's out of sight and out of mind, 99% of people will never go underwater. It's a really tricky issue to communicate and get support for.
Well, that brings us to maybe back to your experience in the world of media. And you, your organization, you were featured in something, a documentary called Chasing Coral several years ago. And that was, I think, raised some awareness around what was at stake, highlighted the survey you did, and also talked a little bit about the science and the means of tracking, monitoring, and managing these reefs. How is that borne fruit? And is there the possibility that other organizations could do similar things to raise awareness? Is that the goal? Would that be the priority for you and others who are in this space right now, Richard?
Well, I think the success of Chasing Coral has really blown us away, and the support that it's generated. We had an initiative on the back of Chasing Coral called 50 Reefs, where we pulled together different philanthropic organizations and really did the science behind identifying the locations where we should be bolstering conservation efforts. And that's grown into sort of a bigger initiative where we're now working with the likes of partners like WWF, TNC, et cetera, really to try and raise awareness and get support, the support that we need for coral reef conservation. And certainly we're seeing it's been a major shift in that support that's starting to really come together and the collaboration around this issue. So I do feel actually relatively optimistic on the back of, you know, the success of the last 2 or 3 years in where we are heading.
You know, but yet if the culprit here has been clearly identified as rising water temperatures due to climate change, and there's no explicit means of addressing that outside of the Paris Accord and the participation of some governments to reduce that rise as best they can, where do you go from here? Because you can monitor the demise, but what can you do to reverse it if this is really out of your control and the control of anybody who cares about the ocean's reefs?
Well, unfortunately, that is the reality of the situation. Climate change, if we don't get it under control, we will lose all coral reefs. And there is no debate about that. We need to keep global temperatures below the 2 degree rise that is the commitment of the Paris Agreement, with the aim of reducing that global temperature rise to around 1.5. If we don't hit that target, we will lose coral reefs entirely. But arguably, that will be the least of our worries. So there does need to be a real focus on really explaining the implications of not hitting the agreement set in Paris. And coral reefs is one of the perfect examples of explaining that those implications.
So it's an alarm bell. Your hope is that it raises enough concern that as just one additional aspect of the downside of global warming, to get people to move and take action on actually doing what they need to do, which is shutting down coal-burning power plants, doing whatever they can to reduce their carbon outputs in order to ultimately not only save the reefs, but to do good for the world and reduce and at least manage the rise of temperatures in the next 15 to 25, 30 years.
Absolutely. And you know, when you look at coral reefs, this is a planetary ecosystem that is, you know, arguably most at risk from climate change, but they're all at risk. So yes, we would lose coral reefs first, but we would have major impacts on all the other ecosystems on which we depend. We simply cannot afford to not meet the targets set in Paris. And the alarm bell needs to be loud and clear about that.
This is Steve Stein, and you've been listening to my conversation with Richard Vevers, founder and CEO of the Ocean Agency. He and his organization were featured in the Netflix original documentary Chasing Coral, which if you haven't already seen it, you need to see it now. I'd like to wrap up our discussions with an Insider Asia Minute. That's the point of the program where I try to distill and make sense of the conversation you've just heard. In this episode, it's going to be more of a plea than a summary. We, and by that I mean all of us, need to do something to protect the environment, and particularly our oceans in a real way. No more lip service. The evidence is all around us. Coral, and with it, 25% of all sea life, is at risk of disappearing. The consequences are far-reaching, and like the demise of the polar ice caps, there's a ripple effect and likely acceleration in the destruction of these delicate ecosystems. My guest, Richard Vevers, saw it coming years ago, and he's since committed himself to raising public awareness. Rather than squander his early training as an ad man, he brought the art of creative marketing to serve the cause. By thoughtfully blending storylines, images, and key messages, he's lifted the crisis of coral bleaching from the mundane and the matter-of-fact to the epic. This is no easy trick, but that's the power of Vevers' work. In collaboration with the producers of the documentary film Chasing Coral, he shows us that the situation is worse than we thought. The devastation is proceeding at a faster pace than anyone thought possible. Watching Chasing Coral, you sit in horrified disbelief, and then it dawns on you. Indifference is not an option. Tipping points are prescient. Look for the signs, and you can anticipate the moment. We are clearly at a tipping point when it comes to the health of our oceans and the preservation of our coral reefs. What's the experience we need to have, or what do we need to see before we do something about it, is the question. Richard knows a thing or two about the human psyche, and that by triggering an emotional response, people can and will be moved to action. Knowing there's a problem isn't always enough. Seeing with your own eyes, or through the digital extension of our eyes, we go below the surface, literally and figuratively, where in vivid technicolor we witness life one moment and death the next. That's when the conversation starts. For those of us who've lived and worked in Asia, there's an added urgency. On the one hand, we're confronted by a bounty of natural resources and a variety of natural environments that are unmatched anywhere on Earth. At the same time, we see levels of indifference to preserving those environments that's literally unthinkable. This is one of the central themes of this podcast. We're all about showing you the opportunities that exist in Asia and the efforts being made to address those opportunities, but it comes with challenges, some significant. Developing Asia has been magnificent in leveraging technology to sidestep or leapfrog problems that once stumped today's more advanced economies. However, the idea that technology can and will always carry us through a problem or a crisis can be dangerous and might even breed complacency. Take renewable energy, for instance. We spend most of our time thinking about how much more power we can produce for less with wind and solar, but pathetically little effort is made to reduce or better manage the resources we already have. By extension, sea life is finite. There's only so much overfishing and rising temperature that the ecosystem can bear. While technology might aid us in raising awareness and monitoring mankind's impact, it won't save our oceans. For that, we have to rely on a higher calling and a commitment to simply doing the right thing. Everyone, and I mean everyone, has a part to play. There are more than 6 billion people inhabiting this planet, and all of us are consuming. Individually, it seems manageable. Collectively, it's a disaster. Curbing our individual appetites is important, but keeping up pressure on governments and industrialists to stop exploiting and start preserving may prove most essential. The developed and largely industrialized countries of the world have been the greatest abusers, choosing maximum economic growth over environmental protection. Now it's Asia's turn. Will countries in this region wake up to the fact that economic growth at the expense of the planet may not simply mean a dirtier place for us all, but indeed the difference between life and extinction? In other words, if Asia fails to put the environment first, does it much matter what the rest of the world thinks or does? I thank you for listening, and I hope you'll do your part. As always, I'm Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.